This is Rabbi Josh Yoder of the Stanton Street Shul. Thank you for downloading this class podcast. These classes are provided free of charge through the generosity of the Stanton Street Shul community and supporters like you. If you do enjoy them, please consider making a donation to our synagogue's building fund on our website's shop donate page at www.stantonstshul.com.
Good evening. It is Tuesday, May 1st, 2012. Rabbinic Thought and Theology, now starting a segment on Olam Haba, the world to come, which is, you're going to see a lot of fun in terms of dealing with it. I actually split it up into three parts. And this being part one, we're going to discuss mostly what is Olam Haba. The next 2 weeks, we'll discuss who gets it and who doesn't get it. So before we start looking at any sources, when people think of Olam Haba, what's the first thing that comes to mind, or how are you taught about what Olam Haba is?
Willy Wonka's Chocolate Factory.
Willy Wonka's Chocolate Factory. Explain.
Paradise.
Paradise. Well, it's only paradise for some. Baruch Assault didn't end up too well. Or Violet, or the kid who fell in the chocolate. So, I don't know, maybe that's the hell portion of it. But, yeah, so it's some sort of paradise. Anything else?
Well, I mean, what we think about today is reward and punishment.
Reward and punishment, sure. Right? Now, a lot of what we're going to see today, a lot of what people think about Olam Haba, which only literally means the world to come, itself a very vague idiom, a lot of that is informed by later commentaries that try to, for various reasons, come up with an idea of here's what they think Olam Haba is, and then try fitting it in other places. For the most part, all our texts will have the common thread of using the words Olam Haba in the original, with maybe one possible exception. And the goal is to see, well, how did Chazal use this idiom Olam Haba? I want to start with three sources that I consider incredibly important, not just for this topic of Olam Haba, but really for a whole lot of things of rabbinic theology. Ephraim, take us with source number one. This is a Sifrei in Devarim.
Can I ask you a question before you start?
Sure.
I noticed in the sources that there aren't any sources from the Bible.
Well, you won't find biblical sources that I know of that actually use the idiom Olam Haba.
But what about precursors to that, like Sheol?
So that already assumes a great deal. So you have a biblical idea of Sheol, which is used as some sort of afterlife synonym. The question is Olam Haba really the afterlife? Right? When you start assuming that,
Olam is also what is Sheol.
Also true. But today I'm focusing on Olam Haba, not Sheol. I mean, Sheol would take you off in a whole separate direction. It's a great question, and I think that the very fact that you asked the question shows a particular bias, not an incorrect bias per se, but an assumption that Olam Haba is some afterlife metaphysical sort of realm. But is that necessarily true? Right? In terms of the use of the term Olam Haba, how is that used? Mm-hmm. Right? And that's what we're going to focus on. So could you say Sheol is analogous? Maybe if you assume a priori what Olam Haba is.
Okay.
All right?
I'll come back to that later.
Yes. But I will say this. A lot of statements that will be made are going to have biblical references.
Right.
All right?
Like this one.
Yes. Well, the Sifrei particularly is a Tannaitic era source, so it's early in the rabbinic period. Commentary in this particular one on Devarim. So most of it's going to be exegesis. For the most part, it's legal exegesis, but every now and again you'll find something like this that's more homiletical.
Fortunate is Israel from Devarim. All of Israel was gathered by Moshe and said to him, Moshe Rabbeinu, tell us what good God will give us in the future. He said to them, I don't know what to tell you. It should be good for you, whatever is set aside for you.
So it doesn't use the idiom Olam Haba here, but I thought it was important to include here. Like, people ask, well, what's going to be? And says, I don't know, just enjoy what you have now. Tamima, take number two. This is a Gemara in Brachot 34b.
Rabhia
Ben.
Bar.
Yeah, it's a Ben. That means either the B, I should say. It's for Bar. In this case, sometimes it's Ben, but the son of.
Abba, said in the name of Rabbi Yochanan. All the prophets only prophesize regarding the Messianic era, but regarding the world to come, no eye has seen except for God.
Ayin lo ra'ta. All right, Jacob, take number three. This is Gemara in Yoma 66b.
They asked Rav Eliezer, "What about so-and-so regarding the world to come?" He replied, "Have you asked me only about this one?" His evasion was due not to his desire to divert them with words or counter-questions, but because he never said anything that he had not heard from his teacher.
You put all these three sources together, what you find is, at least in the rabbinic tradition, one, no answer about what Olam Haba is from Moshe Rabbeinu, no answer about what Olam Haba is from Nevi'im, from prophets, when you have an opinion that says no one ever saw what this world to come actually is, and one of Rav Eliezer, who didn't have a tradition from his teacher. In which case you have three sources here that even describing what is Olam Haba, and no one really knows. Right? On three, you know, in I think fairly important levels, like from the top of the Mesorah of Moshe, who doesn't know how to answer the question, to, you know, Rav Chiya Barba's, you know, saying that, you know, the prophets didn't have it, and Rav Eliezer, now granted, there's a bit of an anachronism here of saying, you know, of interpreting what came before them, but at least in the rabbinic mindset for, you know, based on these three sources, there's a recognition that when it comes to something like Olam Haba, right, since it necessarily takes place at some future or some other state, no one really knows what that is. So you're kind of engaging in speculation right off the bat, because no one can say for certain. Right? It's an amazing point there, because there's that recognition, in a way, that yes, the, you know, Chazal are going to try to understand the world, but when you start, you can't really paskin, and you can't really rule definitively, oh, here's what the world to come is. How do you know what the world to come is? And here there's actually showing that in terms of a real tradition, both spiritual and rabbinic, there seems to be something lacking. And certainly if a prophet didn't see what a world to come is, how would anyone else be able to know for certain?
Yeah. What made people think there was a world to come to begin with? Meaning, where did they even get the idea?
Yeah, we'll continue. In order to understand that, right, in terms of what the idea of a world to come is, you have to find some starting point in terms of what is this world to come to know, what exactly are they thinking of.
But I mean, even in reference to the alleged story with Moshe, what made them think there was anything in the future?
Well, so that's an interesting point. Like, technically, you could say when it says here, Atid Lavo, could mean just at any point in the future. Which, when you say Olam Haba, world to come, could be it, or it could mean, like, anything towards, a, you know, something happening. Yeah.
Literally that's true, that Olam Haba could just mean the future in this life. But the thing is that these sources... the rabbis are assuming that it does mean something post-death.
How do you know that?
Well, because...
And we're going to...
In other words, it's not clear that they're just talking about the future.
True. It's not clear what they're talking about at all right now. I mean, we only saw a couple of sources. I mean, there's a whole lot more on this one and, you know, more that we're going to see. But yes, technically, I mean, one of the things that we're going to ask, and it's worthwhile to keep in mind, is based in rabbinic literature, does Olam Haba absolutely have to mean and refer to some post-life metaphysical realm? Maybe, maybe not. Right? Could you take source number four for us? This is Gemara Nedarim 8b.
Tell me. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Now he differs from Rabbi Shimon ben Lakish, who said, "There is no Gehenna in the world to come, but the Holy One, blessed be He, will draw forth the sun from its sheath. The righteous shall be healed, and the wicked shall be judged and punished thereby."
Yeah, so according to verse in Malachi. So here, I mean, we'll actually see this again. There's a separate class we have specifically on Gehenna. According to the idiom that Rav Shimon Beish Lakish says, "Ein Gehenom la'olam haba," there is no whatever Gehenom is in the world to come, and this is part of a debate. Implication is that there are others who say that no, there is in whatever this world to come is something called Gehenom. Right? Terry, take this is a two Mishnayot in Avot. This is 4, 16, and 17.
Okay. Rav Jacob said the world is on, is like unto the vestibule before the world to come. Prepare thyself in the vestibule so that may enter the banquet hall.
Right, so it seems to imply here that there are two things. There's Olam Hazeh, there's a this world, and there's an Olam Haba, some world to come. And according to Rabbi Yaakov, this world is some form of preparation for the world to come. And then he continues, he used to say,
more beautiful one is 1 hour spent in repentance and good deeds in this world than in all the life of the world to come, and more beautiful is 1 hour of the even tempered spirit of the world to come than all the life of this world.
Now, so there is whatever this Olam Haba is, all Rabbi Yaakov is saying is that it's really, really, really good. All right. Next is a Mechilta from Mechilta Rabbi Yishmael Yitro, also I believe parallel in Brachot 5a. Rav Shimon Bar Yochai said that dear are sufferings, for there are three gifts that were given to Jews, and the nations of the world desired them, but they were only given through sufferings, and they are Torah, the land of Israel, and the world to come. Elohein Torah Veret Yisrael V'Olam Haba. Then it explains, how do we know this about Torah? How do we know this about... because it says, happy is the man who thou chastenest, O Lord, teach them thy law. Whence the land of Israel? Because it is written, and a man chasten his son, the Lord chasten thee. And it is written, for the Lord thy God bringeth into a good land. And whence of the world to come? For it is written, the commandments is a lamp, and thy teaching the way of life, and the reproofs and sufferings are the way of life. Interesting here. So there's according to this opinion, that whatever this Olam Haba is, it's only obtained through some sort of suffering. Okay? So these are a few general statements about Olam Haba. Haven't gotten into detail about any, we have nothing closer in terms of what it is or what it's like.
What is a Mechilta?
There are a few Mechiltas. These are also early rabbinic teachings. You've got like Mechilta of Shimon Bar Yochai being one of them, and Mechilta of Rabbi Yishmael. These are collected rabbinic teachings from early Tannaic period. They're considered in rabbinic literature on the earlier side of things. Okay. All right, Ephraim, start next section, which would describe a little bit more of, well, why Olam Haba? Go ahead. This is the Sifra, which is also Tannaic. It's considered equal with the Sifri.
Sounds like, a tourist brochure for Olam Haba.
Yeah, well, go ahead.
Go ahead.
And you shall live by them, from Vayikra, for the world to come. And if you say for this world, but isn't all of our end to die, how can I fulfill, and you shall live by them? For the world to come, I, God, am trustworthy to pay reward.
Ah, so this is interesting. So now, according to the Chaybem, what does it mean to live? So everyone's going to die. So are you supposed to live with it? So the answer is Olam Haba. Right? So here, according to this Sifra, whatever Olam Haba is, seems to be some sort of a reward for good deeds. Right? And there's something contrasting it with life, as opposed to this world, which ends in death. There's something about the world to come that's a lot more life-affirming. Make sense from this source so far? To me, I'm going to take the next one. It's the Gemara in Kedushin 40b.
Rabbi Eliezer, son of Rabbi Sadok, said, to what are the righteous compared in this world? To a tree standing holy in a place of cleanness, but its bough overhangs to a place of uncleanness.
Again, these are copied and pasted from the Sincere Translation.
When the bough is lopped off, it stands entirely in a place of cleanness. Thus, the Holy One, blessed be He, brings suffering upon the righteous in this world in order that they may inherit the future world, as it is said, and though thy beginning is small, yet thy latter end shall greatly increase.
All right, so stop there for a second. We don't need to do the rest of the source here. So here we have another affirmation here of you get Olam Haba through suffering, and it's and it depends how you contrast this with the Mechilta of Rabbi Yishmael, the Gemara in Brachot about the things that God gave to us through suffering, whether or not it's necessary, meaning unless you suffer, you won't get Olam Haba, or maybe Olam Haba is a reward for suffering that you happen to do, meaning how does that necessarily work? I mean, according to, you know, source number 6 on the sheet here, right, you only get Olam Haba through suffering. According to this Gemara in Kiddushin, then the only reason why you have suffering is for Olam Haba. So which came first?
How do you define suffering?
How do you define suffering? Interesting question there. The Gemara, you know, spends a lot of time discussing like different forms of suffering. Let's take it in the colloquial, conventional sense of what you consider suffering. I'm not sure if there's a, as whatever subjective that it might be, discomfort in some way, pain. Although even so, if you've got a high tolerance for pain, are you really suffering? Right? Which is a fair question.
How could they tell you this is a reward and you could only get it by suffering? They don't tell you what you have to do in order to suffer to qualify to get it.
Yeah, I you know, my experience is that people usually don't have trouble finding ways to suffer. Like, that seems to be relatively easy.
But, like, I doubt it's referring to our day-to-day narcissistic, superficial, mommy issue suffering. Like, I'm sure it means something a lot.
What do you mean?
Meaning you said that I should impose whatever I want onto the definition of suffering.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't suffer, so I don't know.
You don't suffer?
No.
Never suffered. Go you. Awesome. You know,
do you suffer?
I mean, like, neurologically. Not physically.
Well, you know, different people have different... I mean, that is a fair point. I mean, is, you know, would you consider Yisurim subjective or objective, right? Because if it's subjective, then someone could have everything and still be in a great deal of pain, right? Is it necessarily physical pain? There are people, you know, who can say, you know, have things seem to be going well for them and are in great deal of physical or emotional pain, and other people overtly, you know, seem to have a great deal of obstacles and just smile their way right through it. What's considered Yisurim?
What if you spend your whole life doing mitzvot and never suffer? You still get Olam Haba. What about the Gemaras that we talked about?
That's like, a very good question.
Like, if you send away the mother bird, and there are like several things that you do to get Olam Haba, like somewhere else in the Talmud.
No, that's something else. That we have to get through in our evil class. You are
it's
right.
The same
that was for no. That was for a longer life. Above. That was for Olam Haza.
No. Well, you're both right. You're referring to the case.
Wrong.
You're both referring. No, you're both right in that you're referring to the Gemara that's in Kedushin and that's in Chulin about the guy whose father told him climb the tree to send away the mother bird. Guy didn't on the way down died. Right, fell down and died. So the question is, he did two things that the Torah guarantees long life. And the way, so why did he die? Or, you know, why is it wrong for you to think that, you know, why would it be wrong not to go off and become a heretic? According to one Gemara, that is what Acher Elisha ben Avuya saw that made him go off the derech. And so the Gemara concludes by saying, oh, even though it says Laman Yerichu Yamecha, it doesn't refer to this world, it refers to the world to come. Of course, you know, the Torah actually says Laman Yerichu Yamecha Al Hadama, right, on specifically on this earth, but whatever, difficult Gemara, which we'll have to, you know, take some other time for.
But it doesn't say anything about Olam Haba.
Not specifically in the Pasuk. And in fact, when it says Laman Yerichu Yamecha Al Hadama, exegetically would seem to imply that the world, that it's either this world, or alternatively, that whatever the world to come is in fact a physical world to come. And in order to understand that, we can, need to move on to our section 3.
Well, did you say the Talmud says that that they interpret that to mean Olam Haba?
Yes.
Okay, fine.
Yeah, that's not explicitly in the... But to my knowledge, the idiom Olam Haba does not appear in those words, Olam Haba, anywhere in the Bible.
So that would be in addition to this section?
Yes, but we'll... It's... Yeah. And again, there's only so much we can, you know, do in any given section here. But at least here, in terms of why is Olam Haba, it seems, or at least from these couple of sources, that Olam Haba is some sort of a reward, and there is some sort of relationship to suffering and the world to come. Either it's necessary, or Olam Haba is a way to mitigate suffering. And in this respect, you could almost view the idea of Olam Haba as a way of dealing with the problem of evil, which is when you see bad things happen in this world, or the world doesn't work out the way that you think it ought to, and we have a whole separate class specifically on theodicy and the problem of evil, one solution is, well, yes, in the present, the world isn't going to work out. Things are going to seem unfair. Righteous people will be punished or seem to be suffering, when ostensibly, if you do righteous things, you ought to get rewarded. So one approach to saying, you know, to dealing with that issue is, well, there is some future point, such as, say, a world to come, where people are going to be judged, where, like today, it might not all work out, but somewhere down the line, the scales are going to balance out. Yeah.
I think this is what I was thinking of, is what we read after in Kelohenu, where it says that the Academy of Elijah taught he who studies Torah laws every day has assurance that he will be in the world to come.
Yeah, we'll do that next week. Next week is who gets it, and the week after is who doesn't.
Oh, okay. Because this source seemed to say that you only get it through suffering.
Well, that's what source number 6 seemed to say.
Right.
Source number 8 seemed to say... Source number 6 seemed to say that you can only get it through suffering. Source number 8 seems to say that somehow suffering helps. Or rather, the only reason why righteous suffer is that they're going to get world to come. Yeah, there seems to be, based on those two sources, some correlation between suffering and the world to come.
But based on other sources, there isn't.
Correct. And that's one of the reasons why we do this class, and why you can't take any source in isolation and hold it up and say, hey, this is what it is, right? I mean, we saw for the first three sources where Chazal recognized that they're, and admitted that they don't know exactly what Olam Haba actually is. So you're going to find a range of opinions on things, some of which may even be mutually contradictory, because they're trying to either make their best guess, or they're trying to teach you some other lesson. Yeah.
My take on the suffering thing is, I feel like there's sort of a, I mean, you know, we can say like we don't suffer, but I feel like human, like people have sort of a baseline of sort of an intrinsic suffering, just by virtue of the fact that we're kind of, you know, the uncertainty sort of our place here, just because there's a suffering just from a lack of insight and not really understanding the way things work. And so the Olam Haba is, you know, when those things are revealed and that suffering goes away, when things become understood.
So everyone gets
Olam Haba. Well, that's in 2 weeks. Olam Haba. All Jews get Olam Haba, and then there are a bunch of exceptions.
Right. No, but if we all just suffer as a part of the human condition, then what sets one thing apart?
Also, what would set the righteous specifically? Meaning, the Gemara in Kedushin 40b, when it says, you know, Kacha Kadosh Baruch Hu Mevi Sirim Al Tzadikim Ba'Olam Hazeh, seems to focus specifically on the righteous. Right? Because if it's the wicked, I mean, the message here, I think, is less about Olam Haba than it is about theodicy. Like, why do righteous suffer? Oh, it's because of Olam Haba. If wicked suffer in this world, you don't really have a question for that. Or, like, normal, you know.
What about everyone in the middle?
Well, if, yeah, I mean, the righteous causes a bigger issue. If it's anyone in the middle, you say, oh, whatever punishment you get is because of sin. Again, that's going to have to wait for our class on evil, which is a separate one. I'm sorry, look, I can't do all of Shas in an hour. Trying to organize it one step at a time. I mean, I can try doing it on one foot, but, you know, you're not going to be happy with my answer. Who are you up to? I think Jacob. Source number 9 says, Gemara Brachot 17a. And in this section, I figured it was somewhat important to maybe to get a better idea of Olam Haba by contrasting it with Olam Hazeh, meaning the world to come vis-a-vis this world. What would make them different? What would make them distinct? Go ahead, Jacob.
Okay. A favorite saying of Rav was, Olam Haba, the world to come, is not like this world. That's what the Hebrew says, right?
The future world is not like this world.
So the world to come is not
yes.
like this world.
Lo k'olam hazeh olam haba is the Hebrew idiom.
Right. So just to keep with a consistent translation.
Yeah,
in the
whatever.
Future world, there is, or in the world to come, there is no eating, nor drinking, nor propagation, nor business, nor jealousy, nor hatred, nor competition. But the righteous sit with their crowns on their heads, feasting on the brightness of the divine presence, as it says, and they beheld God and did eat and drink.
Hmm.
Isn't this a description of the world to come that could have gone in the first section?
Well, it says, Margala Bafuma de Rav. Right? So it says here it's a saying of Rav.
All of these things are saying.
Well, yes, but here you're actually having... So the reason why I wanted to put it in this particular section is that it gives us a little bit more of a contrast between this world and the next world. Now,
but
here,
it defines what it is.
Kind of. It defines... It doesn't say this is what it is as much as here are a few...
There.
Here, exactly. Here are a few characteristics thereof. And here he's saying that, describe
what it is. It's also defined by what it isn't.
Right, so, exactly. Specifically, how it's unlike this world. So there's no eating, no propagation, business or jealousy, hatred or competition. Based on what's said here, would you think it's more of a physical or metaphysical realm?
Well, I'd say physical, because you're talking about physical things. I would also say that they may not have made the same kind of distinction between physical and metaphysical than we do today.
How so?
Well, I mean, if you're... Well, first of all, this is from the Talmud, right?
Yeah.
So, like, where are we placing this time-wise?
Time-wise. So, Rav would be a first generation of Mora. Right, ozone layer there. Anyway.
Oh, this is
Could you take the next source? Both Zechariah 4:9 and Gemara Pesachim 50a off it.
Okay. The Lord will be king over the whole earth. On that day, there will be one Lord, and his name the only name.
First, we should all know by now. So, Gemara Pesachim, commenting on this verse.
I'm sorry. Is he then not one now? Said Rabbi
Bar Hanina.
Yeah. Not like this world is the future world. In this world, for good tidings, one says, he is good and he does good. While for evil tidings, he says, blessed be the true judge. Whereas in the future world, it shall be only, he is good and he does good. And his name one, what does one mean? Is then now his name not one? Said Rabbi
Nachman Bar Isaac Yitzchak.
Not like this world is the future world. In this world, his name is written with a yud, and he is read as Aleph Daleth. But in the future world, it shall all be one. It shall be written with yud, he and
yud hey, and read as yud hey. So the two distinctions here are: one is that the future world, or the world to come, is only going to be good, meaning there's not going to be bad in the world to come. And there's also a difference in terms of how we refer to God, both in terms of how it's written and how it's read, which seems to imply that in the world to come, there are actual texts of some way that are written down and are recited. This is referring to the name of God, where we do not pronounce the name of God as it's written, right? The only exception being the Kohen Gadol and Yom Kippur. Whereas according to this, everyone would actually call God by his full real name. Instead of, and that's how it's written, and that's how it's going to be read.
Wow, that's heavy.
Yeah. You want to take source number 11? Psalm 68a.
For if he's the opposed two verses as written, then the moon shall be confounded and the sun ashamed, whereas it is written, more of the light of the moon shall be as the light of the sun, and the light of the sun shall be sevenfold as the light of 7 days. I love that song.
Mm.
It's a Doors song. Jim Morrison, Here Comes the Sun, 1967.
I thought Here Comes the Sun was the Beatles.
No, it's another song.
Oh.
The okay. Beatles, Here Comes the Sun, 1968.
Pesachim was plagiarized.
There you go.
Yes, it was. They didn't allow us in college. There is no difficulty the days. The former refers to the world to come, the later in the days of Messiah. But according to Shmuel, who maintained the world difference from the Messianic age in only respect of the servitude of governments. What can be said, both refer to the world to come. If there is no difficulty, one refers to the camp of the righteous, to the other, the camp of the Shekhinah.
So here there seems to be a distinction between in Olam Haba, whatever this world to come is, there is a Machane Shechina, there's a special area for the divine presence, and Kaan B'Machane Tzadikin, and another for the thing of the righteous. Right? Again, going back to what you were asking to me, where there doesn't seem to be like a middle ground here. It seems that you only find righteous people specifically getting whatever this Olam Haba actually is. Gemara in Ketubot says, and it was said...
Hold on.
Yeah.
This is talking specifically about Yemot HaMashiach.
Yes and no. There's a dispute in terms of what is Yemot HaMashiach and what isn't. According to the opinion of Shmuel, the Yemot HaMashiach we saw earlier that Yemot HaMashiach is distinct from Olam Haba, right? In terms of what the Nevi'im, what the prophets prophesized about.
Right.
And here he's making a distinction between, you have a few verses written here that would seem to be, changing the laws of physics, where, the moon is going to be as bright as the light of the sun. Light of the sun shall be sevenfold as the light of 7 days, meaning some sort of renewal to creation. There's a whole lot more brightness and a whole lot more light. You're still going to have the sun and the moon, but the sun is going to be seven times more powerful, and the moon is going to be as powerful as the sun. I'm not going to do the math in terms of magnitude, but that's what it's going to be.
But where did this all come from? How did we go from Moshe Rabbeinu and Rabbi Elazar having no idea what world... as to these people being so certain that this is what happens in the world to come?
That is a fantastic question. Ask that at the end.
Okay.
Yeah. All right. Move on to Gemara Ketubot 111b. It was said, the world to come is not like this world. In this world, there's the trouble of harvesting and treading of the grapes. But in the world to come, a man will bring one grape on a wagon or a ship, put it in the corner of his house, and it used its contents as if it had been a large wine cask, while its timber would be used to make fires for cooking. There will be no grape that will not contain 30 kegs of wine.
Well, I haven't made wine in a long time.
Right? Now, this particular Gemara... Now, you're trying to discuss whether or not the world to come is a physical or metaphysical realm. Here you've got a thing where if you've got like a... Okay, so we just did a Gemara in Ketubot 111b that described Olam Haba as being really good, well, bad for winemakers if you're trying to sell it at a profit. We'll have to send this to Ami. It seems to be a fairly physical type of a description. Now, you could argue that, well, it's a good idiom, right? Because, people... like wine, and it's a way of saying how there's going to be a lot of abundance in the world to come. So maybe this is just a metaphor, but it's using a very physical metaphor. If I take a Gemara next source, Gemara Bava Batra 75b.
Rava said in the name of Rabbi Yochanan, Yerushalayim of the world to come will not be like Yerushalayim of the present world. Yerushalayim of the present world, to anyone who wishes, goes up, but to that of the world to come, only those invited will go.
So in whatever this Olam Haba is, you actually have a distinct entity called Yerushalayim. Now, based on some of these sources, right, it's not unreasonable to say that whatever this world to come is could very well be a physical plane. Right? Now, in...
It sounds to me, with no context and knowing nothing, just with that Yerushalayim is sort of... sounds like to me a metaphor for like the holiest place in the world.
Yeah.
And just,
it could be, right? And I think that's the important point here, is that you could interpret this in a few different ways. Different people, you could interpret this as, saying, well, it's going to be some metaphysical place where people go after, after you die. Or an alternative way of doing this that would also fit the words is that it refers to some sort of future utopia, right? Or some sort of spiritual utopia. Perhaps if only righteous people are there, maybe it's something that happens after the resurrection of the dead and only the righteous people get to live on this earth in some different realm where maybe some of the laws of physics are suspended. In which case it's, not quite, metaphysical in the sense of spiritual, but it's not the natural world. Right? And we'll see that a little bit more fleshed out next week when we see, who are the people who are guaranteed or a muftashu ben olam haba, and what correlation does that have with the world to come, perhaps? Tamima, take source number 14, Psachim 50a.
And it shall come to pass in that day that there shall not be light, but heavy clouds and thick. What does Yekaroth we... What is that one?
The Kippa'on, it's the, it's from the Hebrew, that's how it translates it. It's giving the translation of, literally means like clouds and thick.
All right,
so it's asking.
Thick mean, said Rabbi Eliezer, this means awesome. The light which is precious, Yakar, in this world, is yet of little account, Kapui, in the next world. Rabbi Yohanan said, this refers to Nega'im and Ohaluf, which are difficult, heavy in this world, yet shall be light, easily understood, in the future world. Rabbi Joshua ben Levi said, this refers to the people who are honored in this world, but will be lightly esteemed in the next world. As was the case of Rabbi Joseph, the son of Rabbi Joshua ben Levi, who became ill and fell into a trance. When he recovered, his father asked him, what do you see? I saw a topsy-turvy world, he replied. The upper class underneath and the lower class on top, he replied. My son, he observed. You saw a clear world.
Right, this is the idiom of, like, whatever is the world to come is an inverse of what we have now. So what seems the opposite, opposite here, the context here seems to be about, those who are honored and those who are light, so the people whom you may respect. And he's like, oh, this is a wonderful person, will be laid low. And again, it seems to be a bit unclear. Now also keep in mind, there's an idiom here of Maichazit. Despite what we saw earlier about prophets not seeing the world to come, the implication here is that he did get some sort of vision of what this world to come might actually be, which is also weird in its own right, because how do you see a world to come in the present? Right? It's temporally
a little again,
off.
Like in the past, like in the early 20th century?
To whom?
I don't know. But I thought I remember hearing a story that this happened. There's some guy, he was a rabbi, kind of fading in and out, like his heart was stopping and stuff.
Yeah, so that gets to be a bit problematic when you get to things like, it's a little bit easier, to go back to the rabbinic sources and either say that they were holier people or to say that they were, that these are metaphors and there are other types of teachings. If someone today says that, I had this trance and I, saw the world to come, you're more likely to think that the person is a fraud. Because there's absolutely no way of, verifying. People say lots of stuff. And the last source of Jacob, Sota 3b.
Rev Samuel ben Nachmai said in the name of Rev Jonathan, whoever performs one precept in this world, it precedes him for the world to come, as it is said, and thy righteousness shall go before thee. And whoever commits one transgression in this world, it clings to him and precedes him for the day of judgment. As it is said, the paths of their way are turned aside. They go up into the waste and perish. Rabbi Eliezer says, it attaches itself to him like a dog. As it is said, he hearkened not unto her to lie by her or to be with her, to lie by her in this world or to be with her in the world to come.
Right, so we have a few things more here. I mean, first off, you've got Rishon ben Nachmani, Bar Nachmani, the name of Rav Yochanan, who seems to make a distinction between mitzvot, right? You've got, if you do one mitzvah in Olam Hazeh, you get it in Olam Haba, but if you do an Avera in Olam Hazeh, it gets sticks to you until Yom Hadin, until some day of judgment. Now, which may or may not be Olam Haba, but it's a certainly, different idiom that's being used there. So ultimately, I mean, you asked the wonderful question. I mean, one of the reasons why I do, these classes to show that, none of the sources here are monodogmatic. I don't think if you take one source and try to say, this is the Jewish position on Olam Haba, at least even the rabbinic period, it's not going to be so accurate. And by showing all of them, you realize that there's actually a whole lot here, which gets to your question again of, given that no one really knew for certain, how do you go from that to people talking about it, or people, whether or not it's speculating or giving metaphor, which is, I think, a phenomenal question, right? Because you could ask on virtually anything here of metaphysics, how do you know, right? So for some things, maybe you can have, exegesis. Maybe you find, like, a difficult couple of verses in the Bible. And maybe by saying, well, this refers to this world and this refers to the world to come, is an exegetical solution
to what the Bible says, depending on which way you start. You can either start by saying, like, oh, I have a few verses in the Bible that are difficult to understand. Here's a way of reading it. Alternatively, you could also view it as, you know, this is how they actually, you know, I'm sorry, yeah.
I know, I was in line with what you're saying, but the question is why did they take those verses and talk about the world to come? There still must have been some reason why they're talking about the world to come, and I would posit from my previous life of classics that there's that at the time that these were being written, the rabbinic period,
mm-hmm.
So like the first several centuries of the Common Era,
mm-hmm.
there was an upsurge in the popularity of the philosophy of Plato.
Mm-hmm.
And in Plato, there's the earliest and clearest formulation of the idea of reward and punishment in a afterlife.
Mm-hmm.
You know, where he describes very clearly some things that were like this one here about drinking in God's presence and not doing business and everything like that. It sounds a lot like that,
mm-hmm.
but Plato was around, what, 400 years before this was going on, and
all depends.
And so I think that the ideas that are being expressed by the rabbis are very much influenced by the ideas contained in Plato's.
Well, partially. When I put this together, I organize these kind of topically, not chronologically.
I mean, what's the earliest source here?
Interesting.
Source here is after Plato, and it's also during a time when
when you say 300s.
The reason why I looked into this initially is because I did a paper when I was in graduate school on a certain poem by Pindar. Pindar lived even a century or two before Plato,
mm-hmm.
and in this ode by Pindar, Pindar was a Greek poet, and he lived in the 5th century BCE, so like 2500 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And his poem outlines something what does he say? He says that when people die, the righteous go to something called the Islands of the Blessed,
mm-hmm.
You know, where they drink nectar or ambrosia, you know, like the food of the gods, not like people food.
Mm-hmm.
And they live out the rest of eternity in like on a desert, not a desert, like a paradise island.
Nice.
And then the wicked have to go back into the world.
Huh.
Oh, interesting. They go to Hades, where. And then Plato's version of it, people who, like souls that come back into this world, are plucked from Hades. You have to, like, convince someone to bring you back into this world.
And
like,
you would argue
Hades.
That that's the earliest recorded notion of a world to come or an afterlife?
I would say that it's the earliest in Western.
What about the Egyptians? The Egyptians embalmed themselves.
Right, so they had the idea of an afterlife, definitely, but it wasn't. But you had to take stuff with you, and you had to like make your own afterlife, and you weren't judged for your good and bad deeds. The interesting thing about Plato's idea is that you're judged. Because for good and bad.
You were judged in Egyptian culture. They had that whole weighing of the heart thing.
You have to take your stuff with you. You know, it's a different idea. Also, there's no parallel to the Egyptian idea of it in the Bible, which you would think there would be because that happened right after we left Egypt.
Mm.
This kind of thing doesn't come up until Plato's philosophy was popular in the Near East.
Interesting, yeah.
What happens to the unrighteous in the world to come?
Mm.
What is the view or the accepted view, rabbinic view, of what happens to the sinner?
Yeah, so there is no one singular accepted view. That's
majority.
Well, there's the one source that we saw.
I don't even think that there's necessarily majority, simply because you have different ideas
that are by definition going to be speculative. And until someone actually experiences it, you know, it says, hey, here's what happens, you're never going to really know. We have actually, one of the classes we're going to do specifically is going to be on Gehenna, whatever that is. That
Gehenna.
That takes its own class.
But Gehenna, according to historians, was a place in Jerusalem.
It's called Gei Ben Hinnom. Yes.
Where the Canaanites sacrificed their children,
referred
them into the...
According to rabbinic tradition, it's specifically Molech, you know, and that's one term, and how that got to some after thing. Yeah, it's Gei Ben Hinnom, certainly. It's called Gei Ben Hinnom. That place kind of, you know, does exist there, but in terms of Gehenna being some hell dimension. Now, going back to the question about what does Olam Haba do, you know, and why would they discuss this? It's an incredibly useful idea, you know, not unlike, you know, what Jacob mentioned. I'm going to have to defer to you because my knowledge in the classics isn't, you know, nearly as good. But it solves a lot of theological problems, in particular about evil. Because if you can address matters of, well, why should you be good in this world if you don't get rewards, or at least not the rewards explicitly promised to you in the Bible? Well, one thing is, well, there's a world to come where you're going to get rewarded. Now you're going to get rewarded there, but your reward there is going to be better than anything that you're going to get in this world. Rambam gives a different approach. In his introduction to Shemona Prakim, he writes it almost as this idea of chinuch, as a way that you train kids, like, you know, just as you would try to train kids by saying, oh, do this now and you're going to get a reward later, that's kind of what Olam Haba is. And he actually gives that idiom, you know, from a chinuch perspective.
Yeah. You know, the difference is that you actually give the kid the reward.
Well, so, you know, there's that matter of, you know, faith involved, that there is something there. But, you know, you also go back to that first verse.
When the kid gets the reward, that makes the kid trust you.
Right.
You never get the reward.
Well, so it's, in a sense, it's kind of out of reach. But then, you know, we go back to the first verse that we did here that's described to Moshe. En yodea ma umalachem. I don't know what to tell you. Ashrechem ma metukan lachem. Right, enjoy, you know, what you have, like, right now, or what's already set aside. In terms of Olam Haba taking a dominant thought, right, you know, it's, you could say, I mean, you could turn this as like, oh, Olam Haba is actually the teleology. Like, this is what you're working towards. This is your end point. Everyone's working towards Olam Haba. You know, it doesn't seem to be, you know, certainly from the Bible, you know, itself, why we do mitzvot. The main reason why, according to God, why we do mitzvot is God tells us, you know, to do it. We have this contract with God that we're supposed to, right? It doesn't seem to be from that. It's like, oh, you're doing this so that, you know, this is your ultimate goal. The shift kind of happens later. Another question that's important is, you know, to what extent do you spend so much time and energy thinking about it? And the Gemara talks about a whole lot of different stuff. Yeah.
I mean, if you want to continue on with the child-parent metaphor, misbehaving child-parent metaphor, it's sort of like a first string and a second string. The first string is you should do the right thing, or you should behave because you should have good manners, or that's what you're supposed to do, or because there's a covenant with God. But when that fails and that starts to falter, you start to threaten and get more extreme and say, well, here's a reward, or you're going to go...
Yeah, that's kind of how Rambam phrases it.
Here's the possibility of Olam Haba, or... whatever Gehenna might be.
Yeah, that's actually kind of how Rambam, you know, writes it. Pretty, you know, like, here's the ideal, and here's something that's not as ideal, but, you know, it works.
So Olam Haba is basically just a bogeyman?
Well, it's not a matter of... You see, again, no one really knows what it is. No one really knows for certain who... I mean, we'll see other, you know, cases
of,
like,
because
someone
doesn't.
That's why
it works. It's such a good carrot on a stick.
Well, it's, you know, it's a subject of, you know, a lot of imagination here. Let me, you know, I mentioned once in Shul that it's, you know, there's a fun thing of looking up an art scroll where, whatchamacallit, where you have debates over, when you have, like, theological statements in the Gemara that might not be in line with what conventional Jewish thought might be, and to see how someone, like the art scroll, would actually translate it. So here's on the Gemara Brachot in 34, on the thing that says, Kol Nevim Kulam Lo Nitbu Ela Limot Mashiach. What we have is source number 2, that the prophets only prophesized for the Messianic era, but for Olam Haba, no one saw it. So here's what the art scroll in the footnote says. The books of the prophets contain many descriptions of a utopian reward for the Jewish people. Rabbi Yochanan maintains that these prophecies refer to the Messianic era. They cannot refer to the world to come, because the reward of the world to come was never revealed to any prophet due to its infinite nature. See Rashi here and to Sanhedrin 99a. Rishonim dispute the meaning of the term the world to come in the context of our Gemara. According to Rambam, our Gemara refers to the spiritual realm, where the soul receives its reward after death. See Hilchot Tshuva, chapter 8. Ramban Nachmanides, however, understands this term to refer to the eternal state of Techiyat HaMitim, the resurrection of the dead, which will follow the Messianic era. See also appendix to the Arscroll edition of Sanhedrin. Rambam writes, a human being does not have the capacity to properly comprehend the goodness of the world to come. No one knows its glory, beauty, and potency except God himself. All the benefits that the prophets predicted for Israel are only physical matters, which the Jewish people will enjoy in the Messianic era when their sovereignty will be restored. The goodness of the life in the world to come is immeasurable and utterly beyond comprehension. The prophets did not describe it by means of analogy, lest they cheapen it by doing so. The sages said all the prophets prophesied only about the Messianic era, but as for the world to come, no eyes except yours, O God, has seen. Hilchot Tshuva 8:7.
Sorry, what's the difference between the Messianic era and the world?
So according to the footnotes,
they're absolutely not synonymous?
According to this, no. And according to the Gemara, explicitly there's a distinction between Yemot HaMashiach and Olam Haba, and according to Rambam, one's physical, one's metaphysical, right? You could also, in theory, like if Yemot HaMashiach, the Messianic era, is some point in the future, say, oh, that's some world to come. Like, you know, you've got, when you talk about eschatology, things that happen at the end of days, you've got a bunch of different idioms that come up in the Talmud, and we don't really know what happens when, because you're never given an order. We know there's something called Olam Haba, because it's mentioned in the Talmud. There's something called some world to come. There's Tchiyat HaMitim, some resurrection of the dead. There's Yemot HaMashiach of a Messianic era. We saw, you know, there's a Yom HaDin, there's some day of judgment, right? You start playing around with the sequences, right? Well, you know, you could say, well, and we'll actually have a separate class on Mashiach, but like, well, you know, Mashiach can come, you can have Tchiyat HaMitim, and maybe Olam Haba is on this world after Tchiyat HaMitim. I also once joked that, you know, no one says Tchiyat HaMitim isn't a zombie apocalypse, which would be technically true, but not what we'd actually want. Maybe that's really Gogu Magog, is, you know, Night of the Evil Dead. I have no idea. I mean, these are things that no one can absolutely know for certain. There are traditions that people have, right? And the main reason of, you know, why I do, you know, these classes, to show that the range is a lot wider than what most people are going to be taught just in the Gemara. Once you get to Rishonim and Medievals, people are going to focus on one idea or another idea almost to the exclusion. But these are things which are completely unknowable. So if anyone says definitively, like today, when people say definitively, this is what Olam Haba is, you know, there's reason to be skeptical. When Chazal do it, perhaps, you know, it's a bias of mine willing to give more of the benefit of the doubt, but there could be other reasons. Meaning, maybe the reason why Chazal actually give more accurate, more detailed, not accurate, but more detailed descriptions of the world to come, including who gets it, is because they're engaging in hyperbole. And because they're saying, well, hey, you're either trying to encourage some action, discourage other action. Perhaps, again, it's how they understood certain biblical verses. Or perhaps it's just how they understood the world. But it's not a matter of poskening, right? This isn't a matter of ruling definitively, simply because when you're dealing with a metaphysical realm, just because any given rabbi has an opinion doesn't mean God is now going to conform the cosmos to make sure that this particular person is right. Maybe, maybe not. I have no idea. And the point of going through these sources is that there's a much greater range in the Gemara that's very, you know, I think worth exploring, and certainly should, you know, give people pause if anyone starts claiming that, you know, they have definitive knowledge of, you know, what happens in the future. Along those lines, next week we're going to describe more in detail what types of people Chazal said are of the caliber to get Olam Haba, and then we'll get the types not, and perhaps we can get a greater dimensions of what some rabbinic perceptions of Olam Haba were, not just in terms of describing what it is, but in terms of who gets it and who doesn't, and try to think about why are these people potentially particularly suited for Olam Haba, and why would other individuals particularly be suited to be excluded?
Isn't there any mention in the Talmud or rabbinic sources about interpreting what Sheol is?
Probably. I honestly hadn't looked that up. Well, again, the reason why I did it this way is I wanted to focus specifically on when the idiom Olam Haba is used.
And it's never used in connection with Sheol.
I'd have to double check if Olam Haba is used in conjunction with Sheol.
Because, I mean, I don't know about in the Talmud, but when I talk to people about what the earliest, like, idea of the world to come is, they always say Sheol.
You know,
Sheol is described as a burning hell-like.
Where
is it described? Like in the Talmud?
I always heard of it as being a very nasty place to go.
Okay, I'll tell you what. I will look up and see if it's ever used in conjunction. One of the reasons why you did it this way is, with the exception of the first source, wanted to focus specifically on Olam Haba, so as not to have any sort of bias. Maybe there would be two separate things, but if you want to know what they thought about Olam Haba, you have to look at the term and you have to look at the idiom.
Right, but if there is
a connection,
the idioms that they're if using it's put, to talk about Olam Haba
I will,
are very similar.
Okay, well, I have made a note of it. I will check to see if they're ever used in conjunction or somewhat similar with each other in some way.
Don't you think there's, we're kind of going on the premise, I guess your premise, or many the premise is that there's no mention of Olam Haba, or that it's not really even alluded to in the Tanakh directly.
Alluded to is something else. I didn't say alluded to. I said the idiom, the two words, Olam Haba.
Okay, fine. Well, Jacob's premise is that it was extrapolated later based on...
No,
the rabbis were the ones who saw it as being alluded to in the Tanakh.
Right. Here's the first, that I know of. The first case of it, you find Yaakov complaining after... the brothers, after his sons presented the ketonet, Joseph's coat that was all bloody, he says, Vayomer Yaakov refused to be consoled. He ered el bini avel sheola. The Art Scroll translation here is horrific. It's like, for I will go down to the grave mourning my son. So it translates here as, Sheol. You also have, he translates here as grave, but, really means something else. You also have from Hala, Yeloha Meitim Yahalu Yavol Kol Yoride Duma, right? Which, and there the term Duma refers more to, there's something there indicating silence. Something that Neil Gaiman picked up
What's
when he did Sandman.
Idiom that, that Yaakov uses on his deathbed.
And, the Gemara actually, says, oh, here's what he was going to say, but didn't. But yeah, again, no one knows because he arguably didn't. So anyway, hope to see y'all next week. And starting this Sunday, we begin our series in the halachic process to try and describe how Jewish law works.